after he taught me to, well, when I broke my arm, well, I told him I couldn't fly, and it was a miserable day. All it was raining like everything. And he was a funny little fellow. Maybe he'd talk, maybe he wouldn't. If he wanted to talk to you, had something to say, he'd talk. If he wouldn't, he'd just sit and look at you. And after I got my student permit, I went out in the car, and my arm was in a cast. And he followed me out to the car, and he told the wife that, "Move over, I want to talk to Vern." He said, "I got a proposition to make you." And I said, "Well, Eldon, I can't go to work. I broke my arm on the job, and I got a claim against the company for pay while I'm off." He said, "Who in the hell said I was going to pay you anything?" He said, "I'll teach you to fly, and you flag for me, and I won't pay you anything, and you don't pay me anything." And that's the way I learned to fly. So then I started flagging for him, he was doing crop dusting, and...
Now, flagging, what were you doing when you were flagging?
Well, I was going to explain that.
Oh, excuse me.
Each swath of the plane, when he sprayed, covered approximately 45 feet with a spray boom. And you'd start 15 feet in from the fence. And you carried a big white flag, well, on a stick. And I could carry that in my left hand. My right arm was in a sling. And I could hold that up so he could see it. And he would line up with me at a point at the other end of the field. But when I see he had lined up with me, then I'd take 15 steps or 45 feet over. And he'd go on by on that swath. He'd make a turn, line up with me again, going the other way. Uh-huh. And I was flagging the field for him so that there wasn't any skips or anything in flying back and forth. So we started at daylight in the morning, and we'd work till about 8, 9 o'clock till it began to get hot, and then the spray wouldn't settle in, and then we'd quit. Well, then he'd take me on I learned to fly in what they call the Aeronica Champ. And it was a little 60-horse airplane, putt-putt, I called it, but it was fun to fly. We'd fly out and look at a field, and he'd show me where he wanted to go, or I'd go after a solo. I'd fly out and take a map and map fields, and then I'd practice my maneuvers to get ready for a check ride. So one day there, of course, a lot of that time I never logged because I figured he was flying the airplane because I was just starting out. I didn't know anything about it except to push the throttle and take off. Well, come to find out, I was doing all the flying and he was sitting in the back. Well, so when I come in, he said, "You come out this afternoon, I want to ride with you." So I went out and about 3:30, 4 o'clock when it began to cool down, and we went in the Champ, climbed up and went through a bunch of maneuvers like stalled, slow flight, and minimum control speed, and learning to control the airplane from all attitudes. We went back in and shot a couple landings and come around, and just as he said, "Make a full stop landing." Well, I figured my lesson was over for the day. Well, when I come in, just as I flared it out to touch down, he hit the throttle wide open and hit the stick and made the wheels hit the runway, and we bounced that plane about 30, 40 feet in the air, and now he said, "Take over and land it." Well, I grabbed the power and got it all set up, and I landed. I still had plenty of runway, and he said, "Okay, let's taxi back." Well, I figured the lesson was over. Well, when we got to the taxiway to go to the hangar, he said, "Let me out." He said, "Now you go up and make 3 touch and go landings, and then come in and I'll ride with you again." Well, I started to sweat. And I'm telling you, my shirt got wetter all the time. And so I taxied up on what was 2-9 then. They call it 3-0. They had changed the And that's the magnetic heading of the runway.
That's the Grand Airport.
Yeah, that's the Grand Airport. So I took off. Well, boy, without him in there, that Champ with the 60-horse engine, it just hopped off. It didn't take very long to get airborne. So I climb up 400 feet and then make a 90-degree turn to the left. And I looked back at that runway, and there it was, way, way down there. And I thought, well, what in the world, you stupid idiot, doing up here? You don't know anything about it, and here you sit, and the runway's way down there. Well, then I sweat some more. Well, the first landing I made was pretty good. Second landing, why, it wasn't quite as smooth, but... And the last landing is what you call a basketball landing. I just dribbled all the way down the runway, and I got it stopped. I started to get out, and he gave me a sign to keep the engine running, and he got in. And he went up, and he said, well, that's pretty good, but I want you to smooth up your landing. And he signed me off. Well, then after that, he'd give me a map and send me out to fly and look the fields over and map the fields. And he didn't have to go. Uh-huh. And that's the way I built up my time of flying. Well, I worked for him until my arm got healed up, and I went back to work on the road. And that fall, we were out elk hunting out west of Ansony Lake. It was the next fall. That fall, we went into Red's, the horse ranch, and elk hunted. And... I flew in with him and flew out, and he checked me out going into Red's Horse Ranch, and that's another tricky place to get in and out of. Well, anyway, the next year we were out hunting west of Ansony Lake, and we'd been out, oh, it'd been a miserable day, snowing and everything. We'd seen a few cows, but there were no horns. And I had a camper on the pickup, and we were sitting in the camper. And I was getting ready to cook dinner. He said, Vern, I got a proposition to make you. And I said, well, can't any more than turn you down? No, he said, I don't think you'll turn me down when I'll tell you about it. Well, he told me about the Forest Service wanting to start using aircraft to fight forest fire with. And that he had made a bid on some B-25s at Davis-Monison in Tucson. He said, I'm going to need co-pilots on all these tankers. He said, all you have to have is a commercial license in those days. Now you've got to have a commercial license instrument and multi-engine rating to fly co-pilot on these tankers. Back then, you just had to have what they called a commercial license. He said, you use my airplane. I had to build up to 300 hours. And he said, I'll help you get your license, and I'll give you the first co-pilot seat. So in working on it, when he brought the planes up, I made a trip to Tucson with him to fly with a co-pilot on one and coming back to begin to get acquainted with the airplane. I think the only time it ever rained in Tucson was the night before we got ready to take off, and they had these planes in an old field. They called it Ryan Field. It was west of Tucson out there. It was an old military field, and the asphalt was about half rotten and was on sand, and these B-25s were a pretty good sized airplane, and they grossed about 38,000 pounds. So we start to taxi out. And that asphalt began to break under the sand was wet, and that asphalt began to break under those B-25s, and we mired one of them down. Well, we killed that engine. They were going to have to get a tractor to pull it out and then try to find a runway heavy enough to get out. Well, we found enough to get out on the main runway, and taxiing out, we had three of them, and taxiing out with the other two, well, we broke through again with another one and got it stuck. Well, there was only one left that was flyable, And Eldon was going to check a fellow by the name of Flick out. He was supposed to fly in the captain's seat. He was a retired Navy commander, and he'd flown a lot of ships in the Navy, just about everything the Navy had. And he was a pretty careful pilot. And he said, Eldon said, well, Lyle, his name was Lyle Flick. He said, Lyle, you and Vern's got to get home. Why don't you see if you can get off of this airplane and head for home? Well, when we fired those, they were 1,800 horse engines on each side, two engines, 14-foot props, three blades, and they created quite a windstorm when they revved up. Well, when Lyle went full power and we started taking off, asphalt started flying. And they said pieces of asphalt as big as a hat was sailing back from that airplane, and they didn't know whether they was going to be able to get the other planes off. Well, just as we broke ground, a pin that holds an escape hatch over the cockpit come loose, and the hatch blew off. And I said, what are you going to do, Lyle? He said, well, we're going to keep going. He said, we can't set this thing back down. That runway doesn't look good enough. So we took off. Well, it wasn't too cold at Tucson. And then they had a heater for the cockpit that they called a south wind heater. It had an air scoop, but it burned gasoline to heat, but we couldn't get there. They'd been in mothballs there, and something was fouled up on that heater, and we couldn't get it to ignite. And we couldn't get the vent closed where the cold air blew in. Well, when we come across the Grand Canyon, we hit a cold front. And it went from about 20, 30 degrees above Fahrenheit to 10 below. And that cold air blowing in, why, I had a pair of jersey gloves and a suede jacket. We had everything on that we could get on, and Lyle would fly it about 10 minutes, and then he'd turn it over to me, and I'd fly it. And one of us would get behind the seat and jump up and down and try to get sawed out.
Circulation.
And we got to Ely, Nevada, and it was getting dark and snowing, and we set it down. I don't think I was ever so cold in my life. And to get in and out of a B-25, they had an escape hatch in what they called the belly. Mm-hmm. And you pulled a release, and this door swung down, and it had four steps on it that you went down those steps to get out underneath the airplane. When we taxied up to the office where they wanted us to tie down, well, Lyle started down first, and his feet was so cold he couldn't feel the steps, and he just went down in the heat and landed in the snow on the ground underneath. And he said, don't step on me, and I rolled, come down, and I couldn't feel the steps. And I'll tell you, that was one time a drink of whiskey tasted awful good. When we got into they called the hotel in Ely and asked if they had any space, and they said, yeah. They said, we got a couple pilots that's about half froze. And I'm telling you, they gave us each complimentary drink before dinner. And I don't think I ever tasted whiskey that tasted any better than that. That just kind of helped take the frost out all the way down. But next day we tried to take off. And it'd snow, and then it'd break away. And United come in from Salt Lake, or from Boise. And we asked him what the weather was in Boise. Oh, you can make Boise all right. So by the time you fired one of those big airplanes up and run up and got them warmed up, you'd take about, cold that way, it'd take about 30 to 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, by the time we took off, the weather began to change, and we got up this side of Wells, and we hit another snowstorm. So we turned around and started back to Ely, and it was snowing there, and we couldn't get back to Ely. Lyle said to me, he said, let me see the map. He said, when in the Navy, I always had a navigator. He said, I wanted you to do the navigating. Well, I was trying to do the best I could, because I didn't know too much about it then, but anyway, I was trying to keep him on course. He grabbed the maps, and one thing about Nevada, your mountain ranges all run north and south, and there's valleys in between them, and dry lake beds. So when we would hop over one of these, and he'd start up, and we'd hit a snowstorm, and he'd turn around and go back. And I kept track of the ridges that we hopped over. Finally, I said, he thought we was way over in around the Steens and in there. Well, that's pretty rough country in there around the Steens and that Jackass country and down through there. And I said, Lyle, are you afraid to die? He looked at me so funny and he said, no, I don't think so. Why? Well, I said, if we're where you think we are, we might as well say our Father who art in heaven, because we're not going to get out of it. But if we're still where I think we are, we've got one chance of following one of these valleys up till we hit Snake River, and then I'll know where we are. He took his hand off the controls and turned it over to me, and he said, you fly this any way you wanted to get out of here. He said, I'm lost. So we turned up one of those long draws down there, and sometimes it was only about 50, 60 feet off the ground, but I kept the ground in sight. And it didn't, it was traveling at 200 miles an hour, it didn't take very long to come up through there.
Yeah.
And pretty quick I saw a body of water. And I said, if I've calculated right, well, that's Snake River. And I said, Boise is right off to our left. Well, it was that Snake River above Bruno Dam. And when we broke out across there, we flew right across Mountain Home Air Force Base, right down the middle of it, about 500 feet off the deck. And lucky the 25 still had the old military markings all over. The guys were standing out there looking up at us as we went over, and we were on a flight plan. Our time was almost up. So I flew, we couldn't transmit. We could receive on the radio, but we didn't have any transmit crystals. So I flew as close to the Boise Tower as I dared, and they said, if you read us, we'd know your wings. Well, I have rocked the wings, and so we got this side of Ontario and hit another snowstorm. And we had to turn around and go back to Ontario. We got on the ground there, and here are the other two B-25s. One was taxiing in, the other one was tight, they were just tying it down.
Okay.
And we said, where you guys been? Oh, we've been flying around out there in the snowstorm. They said, where you been? I said, we've been out there in the snowstorm. How in the world we missed each other, I don't know, but it was just the good Lord had his arms around us. That was all there was to it. We set those planes down, and the next morning we cleaned a foot of snow off the top of every one of them before we could take off and come on home. But what should have been about a 2.5 hour flight lasted 3 days. And we about scared the people at Le Grand half to death. We lined up in a kind of a military formation right over here and come across the valley at about 150, 200 feet right over to Le Grand and made a big turn right over to Le Grand and then peeled off, went into the airport to land. And those big old rides on those B-25s that David, the old flick, he was using all the power it had, those big old props was really a growling.
It was still pretty cold with no canopy there.
Well, we got, they brought the canopy.
Oh!
And then in the meantime, when we were at Ely, I found that vent and I taped it shut so that air didn't blow in on our feet anymore. And we bought additional clothes, so we had plenty of clothes at Ely. We were good and warm coming in here and enjoying the ride. And neighbor lady come out and told the wife, said, I think we're being bombed here. Those look like bombers and they're flying slow. I hope they don't hit anything very vital. And Bernice, my wife, said, don't worry, they won't. They just a bunch of idiots coming home. Well, then I didn't fly after I got my commercial license. I went to work back on the road, and then I had a derailment at Meacham, and I got pulled out of service. Well, I had my commercial license then, and that was in 60, and that's when the lightning storm come through and set the first big fire at Anthony Lake. And we started using the, what they called borate then. It was the crude to bore soap chips. When they mined the borax and refined it for Braxol and the borax soap chips and stuff that they'll use in the laundry, they mixed 4 pounds of it to a gallon of water. A gallon of water weighs 8 pounds, and 4 pounds of that made a mixture weigh 12 pounds. And we carried 1,000 gallons of that, or 12,000 pounds. The airplane carried 964 gallons of gasoline and 25 gallons of oil on each engine. And on, we grossed 38,000 pounds on takeoff. When we dumped that slurry, we had it hooked up with an electric switch. I could dump 500 gallon or 1,000 gallon or stagger them, depending on what the fire boss demanded. There, it had a vent scoop on the top. I think it was a 27 cubic inch air scoop. And when we'd open those doors and get rid of that load, we'd get rid of 12,000 pounds in 3 seconds. And the change in the attitude of the airplane, it put on what they call a geoload, or the power of gravity pulling against you when the airplane is in negative configuration. The most we ever pulled was 2.5 pounds of geoload, or 2.5 G's, I should say. And the planes, if I remember right, was stressed for 6 negative G's and either 9 or 10 positive G's. The negative G is the down pressure on the wings as the pressure is going up. And the positive G's is the pressure underneath the wing that holds the airplane in the air. And several times we used that G load to help get us out of a tight spot. We could fly 5.5 hours a day. That's what the Forest Service would allow us. Before the summer was over, I had accumulated pretty close to 150 hours of multi-engine time. And we were instructed on how to land, how to take off. The fellow I flew with was a B-17 pilot. His name was Howard Mays. And he had flown 30-some missions over Germany during World War II. And he brought in a B-17 several times, pretty badly shot up. Been shot down behind the lines and spent a year or two the underground getting out of Germany back into England. You never could get him to talk much about it, but he told me how much wine he drank and how good the wine was over there. And that he'd held his crew together till clear to the Pyrenees into Spain. And they got caught in an avalanche going over the Pyrenees in the wintertime and killed the tail gunner and the co-pilot. But he got the rest of his crew back to England, except for the two. Walked into camp in England, and the commanding officer said, "Well, Mays, where in the hell have you been?" He said, "There's a 25 there, or a 17 there, waiting for you to go on that needs a captain." And Howard said, after a year and a half of dodging bullets, he said, "I thought I'd get to be on the ground." And he said, "I flew 10 more missions over Germany after that."
I thought they usually flew 25 missions.
Well, 25 to 30.
Yeah.
And he wound up, I think, something like between 38 and 40 missions.
We.
And he was one of the sharpest guys to fly with. Well, he taught me how to land and take off. And if we had a load, I'd fly it out to where the fire was. I knew the country around here, so they'd tell me where the fire was, and we'd just take off and go. And he'd take over when we made the drop. I made the drops, and he'd fly it back. Then we'd load up, and he'd take off the next time. After we made the drop, I'd fly it back and land it and load up, and then I'd take off the next time. And that's the way we worked. And I learned quite a lot about flying multi-engine airplanes for him. The lightning storm that came through that set Anthony Lake was one of the most vicious storms, well, until we had one here about a month ago, or 2 or 3 weeks ago, that I ever saw. Those storms, after I flew into tanker, I should clarify this. After I flew tanker, I went back to work on the road. Well, then when I retired from the road, I had my commercial license. And I got an instrument rating, and I flew a lot of charter and flew for Forest Service, flew a lot of forest fire. And I learned that a lot of our electric storms generate in around John Day. The heat that comes off the desert down there, the Albert Desert and the Ebert Desert, the wind will blow that heat into the mountains there north of Burns, where the timber and the cooler air is, and will generate these electric storms. And they'll start at the Strawberries and move over the Elkhorns right into this area on out to the northeast. And most all electric storms move from the southwest toward the northeast. Few of them move from the west to the east, but the biggest majority of them will run from the southwest to the northeast.
It's interesting.
And you can sit here in the valley and watch a storm out toward Elgin or over toward Wallow. That storm's passed. Unless it's a freak storm, you'll never see any more about it. The next storm will be coming out of the Elkhorns or coming through. The lightning had set a big fire up near Missoula, Montana, right on the breaks of where the Salmon River turns west from Idaho down to Riggins. And see, the Salmon River flows on a northerly heading to a little town right at the foot of the, I can't say the name of it. Anyway, the Salmon River turns left where they call the river no return, where they drifted.
I've heard of that.
From there down to Riggin, and there's no roads or nothing in there. Well, this fire was right on the top of the ridge above where that Salmon River makes a turn toward the west. And they called it the Elbow Fire. And we had been flying on that for about 4 or 5 days. Get one load right after the other, and it was really spreading. We were coming back from there the night the electric storm went through that set Anthony Lake fire. And as we come into the valley over Mount Harris out here, the lightning flashed right over the airplane. We were right at the edge of it. And it almost blinded me. I was flying. And we picked up what they called St. Elmo's Fire. And it was just one big arc of fire all the way around those big propellers, and with sparks flying off the ends of the tips of the propellers. The little fires was running around all through the cockpit. You move your hands or your fingers, the little blue flames would run up and down your arms, your hands, your pants, like you couldn't feel a thing. But you could see that fire running up and down your fingers, and it make your fingers glow. And you'd touch a control, you couldn't feel anything, but you move your hand, and you could see those sparks fly off your fingers.
This wasn't injuring you in
any
way.
No, we weren't grounded.
Uh-huh. Oh. See, had you been grounded,
it killed us.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the magnate compass was spinning like a top. It'd spin first one way and then just stop and spin the other way. And then it'd stop and spin the other way. there's a gyro compass in an airplane that is run off a vacuum that's non-magnetic. And that thing was spinning so fast you couldn't even get the blur. And the instruments all went goofy. And Howard said to me, he said, "Well, buddy, go ahead and land it." And he said, "We've got to get it on the ground, but you stay in the cockpit." So when we got taxied up to the gas pump, why, he dropped this escape hatch so there wasn't any way to touch it. And he was a small man. He and I looked like Mutt and Jeff working together. He was about 5'6", 7", and I'm 6'3". Well, anyway, he got down, and before he touched the ground, he just folded his arms and dropped through that hole in the bottom of the airplane right to the ground. And then he picked up a ground wire, and when he touched the landing gear of the airplane and grounded it, there was a spark about as big as the palm of my hand jumped off that landing gear. And he went around various places touching that airplane with the ground wire and grounded it. And he said, "Okay, buddy, now you can get out."
Boy.
And then we gassed it up. And the next morning when I pre-flighted the airplane before we took off, here was a little black arc mark right out to the tip of each one of the propeller blades, maybe two or three on a blade, where that static electricity had gone out to the tip of the propeller. Observers on most of these lookout towers. And when the Anthony Lake fire started, it was five fires burnt together. And I'd give anything. I had sent my movie camera on a DC-3 to get pictures of dropping smoke jumpers in Hell's Canyon, and I didn't have my movie camera with me. When we flew on the Anthony Lake fire, it just looked like five big arches. The smoke went up and made an arch, and the sun was shining through between each one of those. I'd give anything if I'd had a picture of it, but I didn't have my camera. It was already gone. I've got moving pictures of that about a 400-foot reel of Anthony Lake fire. Smoke jumpers jumping out of a DC-3 over Hell's Canyon. Dropping slurry on the fire at Anthony Lake.
Wesley Toll said when you dropped slurry up there at Anthony Lake, you just turned him white with his D9 cap.
I was going to tell you about that. So, but anyway, to start with, one day there, you see the Forest Service, each one is designated with a number, like the fire dispatcher is 22, and Glass Hill was maybe 204, Point Prominence would be something else, depending on the area. Well, it was hot, and when it's hot, the density altitude of the field out here, the field is 2713. Well, when it gets real hot, the lift on the field to get off with a loaded airplane is equivalent to taking off from a runway at 6,000 to 7,000 foot elevation instead of 2,700 feet. Grossing 38,000 pounds on takeoff, we'd use every bit of the runway to get off, and sometimes we'd pull the gear up to keep it from hitting the fence when we went over the end of the runway. We was flying by this lookout, and one of these ladies that was in the lookout called Baker, the fire dispatcher, and said, "Uncle, X-ray 22? He said, "What is it?" She said, "This is 204. I have a complaint to make." He said, "Well, what's your complaint?" She said, "I don't like these big airplanes flying so close to my lookout. It rattles the windows." And he said, "Oh, 204. Shut it off." He said, "What's your complaint?" She said, "I don't like these big airplanes rattling, flying so close to my lookout. It rattles the windows." So this maze that I was flying with, he didn't say anything. And it was my turn to fly out next time. He said, "Oh, buddy, I'll fly this time." I said, "All right." So it didn't make any difference to me. He was captain, and if he said he was going to fly, why, He was the boss. So we took off, and there was an engineer off the road that parked right at the end of runway 34. Brand new pickup. And boy, when we went across, he had slid down in the seat till I could look right down his throat that he was looking up. And I bet those propellers didn't miss that pickup but by inches. And we'd have to make about 2.5 turns here in the valley out over a field to get elevation enough to get up. Well, this Mays had a habit of wearing, he always wore gloves when he flew. Why, I don't know. I don't like gloves when I'm flying, but he always wore gloves, and he'd put those gloves on, and then he'd take his fingers and pull them down like this, and then he'd take a hold of the control. He reached down to the throttle, added another couple inches of manifold pressure, and that's that in power. And he gets to ease that plane over just a little bit closer to that lookout when we went by. Just before we got to it, he reached over and got a hold of the prop control. See, they're a constant speed prop, and you can change the pitch by changing the controls in there. He pulled that prop control back and then come back up to cruise. Those big old 14-foot props went around. He said, "Buddy, I'll bet that rattled her windows. We never heard a peep out of her." Later years, I was at the Elks Temple, and a guy by the name of Merrick, he said, "Vern, I've got a question I want to ask you." He said, "What happened at Glass Hill?" He was heard about it and remembered. He said, "I never did hear the outcome of what you crazy bums did." So I told him what happened. And he said, "You know, she never let a peep out of her." He said, "I bet it broke every window in that lookout."
Oh, boy.
Well, this engineer that had parked right off the end of the runway, how he got by the guard, where they had guards out to keep people off the airport because we were so busy in so many airplanes, they were afraid somebody would walk into a propeller. He said, "Say, you come awful close to my new pickup. And his name was Rodenberger. I said, "Rosie, nobody but an idiot hoghead would park right off the end of the runway because he didn't have a brakeman to lead him around." I said, "If one of those engines had coughed, just as we went over your pickup, we took you and your wife and your new pickup right along with it." But we made...
You were going to tell me about when you dropped on that cat up there at Anthony.
When we flew, we took off. That cat was right off Anthony Butte. There were two of them. There were two cats following the fire line there. And they got in the smoke and fire, and it killed them. The caterpillar died. The chase plane, or the bird dog plane as we called it, that was circling around called us. Our plane was number 21, and they said, "2-1, there's two caterpillars that's trapped in the fire down here. If you can pick them up, hit them." Well, we circled and circled, and all we could see was a snag sticking up out of the smoke, at the top of a snag. As we made it one circle, I happened to spot them down there where they were by this snake, away from this bank. And I told Howard, I said, "I picked up the two cats that are right down there," and I pointed out the snake. So he made another turn, and he pulled to the right of that snake, so it was on his left, and he spotted them down there. So we used this snake as a spot to drop on, and we just hoped we'd hit them. So we went up over Anthony Lake, put flaps on, and slowed up. We were supposed to drop at about 140 miles an hour. Well, we called it knots, which would be pretty close to 160 miles an hour. And we slowed it up and come down, and just as we got there, he gave me a sign, and I dumped it. And Chase Plain says, boy, that just looked like you cut a hole in the smoke. Go back and get another load and drop it right in the same place. So we went back and loaded up, and we dropped it. And they fired those cats up and drove them out. Well, later that fall, I was working out of Portland. And I was living in a trailer park, and one of my neighbors, we got talking about airplanes and flying, and I showed him these movie pictures that I had movie through. I had taken a Anthony Lake Flyer, and he told this guy, he worked in the shop where he did, and he wanted to know if he'd come out if he could visit with me, and I said, well, sure. He come out, and he said, I was hoping someday I'd get to meet the guy that saved my life. He said, I was driving one of those cats that died in the smoke. He said, I thought we were dead. We had buried ourselves in the dirt underneath the cat's tooth. It was a little bit damp and cool to get what little air we could get. And he said, when you guys come in and drop that, he said, you painted us just the color of that borate from one end to the other. And he said, I never felt anything that felt so good in my life. And he said, you guys saved our lives. He said, and I'll never forget it. But that was one of the things that meant more to me working that summer, that I had helped save somebody's life and that they had was able to live and tell about it.
In working with flying and the railroad, which one would you prefer to do? What?
Well, when I hired out on the railroad, I thought that was the best thing it was. Well, it was. It was the best job a person could get. And I was always interested in flying. When I was a little kid, my dad subscribed to the Popular Science magazine, and back then they had each issue had an article about flying, in it, showing how to maneuver an airplane, how to handle the controls. I read everything I could on it, and I always wanted to learn to fly. An airplane meant a lot. It was of interest to me. And when I got a chance to learn to fly, I don't know of anything that I enjoyed any more than the flying. I flew for 41 years. I had a pilot license for 41 years. I owned my own airplane. I flew it over 2,000 hours. When I lost my physical in 97, I had accumulated almost 5,000 hours of flying time. And
what size airplane did you own?
Huh?
What size airplane did you own?
I owned a little two-place Cessna 140. That's the model of it right up there.
Oh.
And new. And it had a 90 Continental in it, and Snoop, get out of there.
It's all right.
It had I put a 115 horse light coney in it, and I flew a lot of search and rescue, and it, with that more power, it didn't increase the speed any, but it gave me a little more power to climb out of these canyons when I was flying search and rescue. And it was a fun airplane to fly. It was an airplane that you could get a lot of enjoyment out of, but you didn't want to get too complacent to think you had it mastered, because it'd bite you if you... It would spin with you, I'll tell you that.
You said it was real interesting to fly into Red's Horse Ranch. What was some of the obstacles that you run into when you flew into Red's?
Well, one thing, I got turned in for flying too low. Red's Horse Ranch set right in the bottom of the Big Minum Canyon. To go in there took 18 minutes in a 206. I flew a 206, Cessna 206. Had a 300 horse engine on it. And it cruised about 100 and, all around 145 to 150 knots. I'd climb out at 80 and 90 knots out of the ground. To go over Moss Springs, we had to climb up 6,100 feet. If we went over by Point Prominence over Rock Springs, we still climbed up to 6,100 feet. Then you had to drop down and work your way down into the canyon, and Red's was 3,600 feet. Going over Moss Springs, as soon as I broke over the hill toward the Little Minum, and we turned down the Little Minum, it was probably about 4 or 5 miles. I'd put the nose of the plane down and lose about 1,000 to 1,500 feet until I crossed the Hogback, what they call the Hogback. Mm. It was the divide between the Little Minum and the Big Minum. And the summit on it was 5,000 feet. That is, I cleared it at 5,000. The actual summit was probably about 4,500. We'd make a turn over Red, a 360-degree turn, and lose another 1,000 feet. And then fly about 2.5 miles down the river and get your speed. By then, you had to get your speed down to approach speed, which was around 75 to 80 miles an hour. There was a wide spot down there where we made a turn to turn back up the river. But then we'd line up with what they call Minum River Lodge. There's a script there, and it was north and south. Red's was northeast and southwest. And we are wrong, northwest and southeast. But when you let down, you have to be down when you come over the Minum River strip to about 40 to 50 feet off the ground. Well, the Minum River makes a bend right between the two strips, and you could get all kinds of air currents there. You didn't know whether you was going to get a lift or a drop, and you had to be on the power so that if you got the lift, you eased off on the power. If you got a drop, you added a little power, but not enough to change your approach speed. And he made about a 45 degree turn and set the runway on the runway. It was a one-way trip. You landed up the river and you took off down the river. There was no going around. Once you went into land, you went into land.
You had to go across the fence and into the field?
There was the field.
Uh-huh.
And I got a picture, I'll show it to you in there, of me on just turning on final. And when you took off, why, you took off down the river, and you just hoped you didn't pick up the tailwind of coming down the mine. So, after 11 o'clock, if it was real hot, you didn't want to even try to go in there. There just was no air down in there. The plane had just dropped right out from under you. And I had come out late one day. I made one more trip more than I should. And I fought that airplane almost to where the highway goes to Willow before I got out of the canyon with that 300 horse engine. I didn't know whether I was going to make it a time or two. It just felt like that plane was starting to drop out from under me with using all the power that I had. So it's a tricky canyon. It's claimed a lot of airplanes.
I understand that.
And I had a guy to fly in one time. The guy I was working for was named Mike Trindle at Baker. And he said, take all the seats out of the 206 room. This guy's got a lot of equipment. Well, he flew into Portland. He came from Fort Worth, Texas. He flew into Portland and he drove a rental car to the Air LeGrand. And he, I never saw so many cases of bows and arrows and camouflage clothes in my life. That 206, come on, that 206 was piled full. So when we went in there, I didn't know he was a pilot. And I noticed he watched me every move I made, and I went over Moss Springs and put the nose down and down the canyon and went into ribs and landed. Got unloaded, and he come over and he shook hands with me and he said, well, that was a very good demonstration of handling an airplane. He handed me his cards, and here was the senior captain of Southwest Airline, checked out in 747s and everything. Flew from here to the Orient and all over. And I said, I looked at it, and his name was Mark Thomas. I said, Mark, I feel I was on the wrong side of the airplane. If I'd known I was flying with somebody like you, that I'd put you in left seat. No, you wouldn't, he said. Now, I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Draper. You can have all this you want. I wouldn't put an airplane down in here if you give it to me. And boy, when I flew him out, why, he was watched every move I made and got out, and he said, you can have that. I wouldn't go in there for anything in the world. Then I got turned in for flying too low. Flying for the Forest Service and charter work, flying over a wilderness area, an airplane isn't supposed to fly below 2,000 feet. So I'd made 7 or 8 trips in there. I don't know. I can't tell you how many I made in there because I logged up to about 600-700 trips. And then I flew a lot of trips after that. I got tired of logging each trip in my logbook, and I just so many trips into Ritz or a Minor River Lodge. So when I got home, my wife said to me, said, what have you done? I said, I don't know. I haven't had any close calls or anything. I don't know why. She said, the FAA is hot. They want to talk to you. Well, before I had a chance to call the FAA guy's name was Greg Symes. Before I had a chance to call Greg, the telephone rang, and I picked it up, and he said, Vern, what are you doing up there? I said, going in and out of Reds. Why? I tried to get them to ride with me so they could see what we had to put up with. The FAA wouldn't ride with you down in there. They wouldn't go in there at all. And I said, going in and out of Reds. Well, you're flying kind of low, aren't you? I said, no, I don't think so. I said, not any lower than I have to. But he said, you've been below 2,000 feet over the wilderness area. I said, okay, now you tell me something, Greg. How am I going to go in and out of Ritz and stay 2,000 feet above the wilderness area? He said, I figured you'd ask me a silly question like that. And I said, you asked me a silly question, so I want a silly answer. I said, why? Well, he said, some guy had to give the tail number of your airplane and said you're 2,000 feet lower than he. He was sitting in Horseshoe Basin up to the north of the point, Moss Springs, and he said I was 2,000 feet lower than him. And I said, if I was 2,000 feet lower than him, I'd been plowing up the trees in the Little Minum Canyon. And Greg said, well, just don't aggravate them too much. I said, come on, take a ride with me someday. No, he said, the hell with you.
Well, it sounds like there's some really good experiences in and out of there. Yeah.
I flew another guy out. He had a 6-point bull. And it was a beautiful racklehorn. And he had the cape and everything with it. Well, when we went to load it in the 206, the only way I could get it in there was turn the horns toward me in the seat and lay it on, kind of on edge. And when I put it in, well, the nose gear went right down on the sitter right to the point. And I thought, boy, that's going to throw too much forward CG, and I've got to offset it. So I picked up the... Boy, he wanted me to fly the whole six-point bull out at one time. And I said, no way. I said, I can bring 1,100 pounds out, but that's all I can. I won't take any more than that. Well, I wound up with a little more than that. So I put a hindquarter in the back. Well, the hindquarter of that six-point bull put the tail right down to the ground. And I thought, boy, now I am into it. So I tried moving that, and that didn't change. And when they cut the animal, why, one front quarter, they made it a little smaller than the other. So we raised the head and cape and slipped that front quarter about halfway under the head, so it was changed the CG of the airplane so the tail come up. Well, it's him and I in the front seat, then that gave me enough forward CG to handle it. At that time, there was a bog hole right in the middle of the runway up there. I had about 800 feet to get off. And it was getting late in the afternoon by the time I got all that stuff loaded. And if I went in that bog hole, I knew I was stuck. So we had a way to taxi up to the what they call the dog leg, the extreme end of the runway, and I took every bit of it I could get. And I wound that engine up, just all the power I could get into it, and I didn't put any flaps on. Flaps are used to help lift the airplane in a load. And you had 10, 20, 30, and 40 degrees of flap. And we usually use 10 degrees of flap, 10 to 20 degrees of flap to get out of there. Well, I just held it without the flaps, and I got up to about 40 miles an hour in the first 800 feet. And just before I got to the bog hole, I put on 10 degrees of flap and just held a little back pressure on the controls. And I was just kissing the top of the water with the main gear as I went across to the other side. Just before I got there, I went another 10 degrees. And then by the time I got to the other side, I had enough speed that I would begin to fly. Well, the air was rough, and an airplane's got a stall warner in there. If you drop below a certain speed, that thing will beller at you to let you know that you're too slow. Well, that stall warner was a squalling all the time. Well, I thought if I'm going to lose it, I can set it on the Minum River Strip and hope I can get stopped. Well, by the time I got over the Minum River Strip, I had about 200 feet elevation. So I kept it coming. It hit a little rough air, and that stall warner let a squall out of it. And he grabbed for everything he could find. Thank God he didn't grab the yoke. We got to LeGrand, and we got it unloaded. And that, I had to fly that airplane to the ground. I couldn't glide it. I had so much weight, I had to use power all the way down to the runway. When I got it unloaded, I said, are you going back and help me load the rest of it? No, to hell with you. He said, I'll pay you for whatever it is to get it out of there. Just get it out of there.
Well, you're still living in Union after all these years. You must have liked it over here.
Well, for one thing, the reason I come here, John, I couldn't, when I moved back from Portland, I couldn't buy a piece of property in LeGrand to put this. I had this double wide trailer in Portland. Uh-huh. And I couldn't put it on my own property in LeGrand. I was at Sundowner, and my wife at that time, she was sick. She had heart trouble, and she didn't like it there. She didn't like the trailer park. And we found this vacant lot, and I bought it, and I've been on this corner 32 years. And I set it up for home. She passed away in 75, and the railroad got retirement age, 30 years of service, 60 years of age, you could get your full pension. And I wanted to retire. It was getting so that I didn't like the way, well, the officials we had weren't railroad men. They didn't know how to operate a train. Well, after she died, I didn't see any use retiring. And then I remarried, met a woman that we got together. We had gone together years ago. She had been married and her husband had been dead, and my wife was dead. And we renewed acquaintance and got married late in the fall of 75. I worked a year so she'd be covered. I come in one morning, her name was Selma, and I said, Selma, what would you say if I retired? And she said, well, that's up to you. If you think we can, you can, why, if you want to, why, that's fine with me. Well, I said, let's do some figuring. So we figured what it cost me to make a trip. My road expense, my union dues, my job insurance dues, income tax, and everything. I called the railroad retirement, and they give me an estimate of what I would get. And when we sat down and figured, I was working for $25 a month. And I said, that's enough of that. So I gave the company, the 1st of October in 76, notice that I was going to retire. I took my pension the 31st of October in 76. Up to now, I've been off 26 years. And I don't regret a minute of it. I've had...
Sounds good to me.
I've had a lot of interesting things. I've traveled a lot. I've been in every state west of the Mississippi except Louisiana. I've seen a lot of points of interest. I've been as far east as Nashville. And I've been to South Bend, Indiana. I think I've been in either 9 or 10 states east of the Mississippi. And... I wouldn't trade the pictures I've got and the trips I've had. I've been as far north as Jasper, British, Alberta, Canada. Clear across to Winnipeg, across Canada, back into the States. Spent about 3 weeks up there. Very interesting. Saw Banff, Lake Louise, all the way through there. And I've been to every point of interest that I could find. And one point that I would love to go back to, but I'll never do it now, is the Oregon Pipe National Monument south of Tucson down on the Mexican border. The cactus there grows, it looks like it's a pipe in a pipe organ. Some of them doesn't have spines on them, some of them does. There's a tree there they call Sunita, and it's got thorns on it. I'm telling you, these thorn bushes around here, they don't have any thorns at all. You should see that Sunita. There's mesquite and a lot of others in that park. There's, I think, 70-some different varieties of cactus. And... It's